Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's March 2nd, 2022. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Bishop, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson's arriving. Other senators may join us later in the meeting. We have one item on the agenda today. The committee is going to hear a presentation on the Alaska's Oil and Gas Severance Tax Order of Operations from Department of Revenue. And if Mr. Dan Stickle could come forward, he's been here many times. But for those watching at home, we're going to go through what we call the Order of Operations, which is how, at a very high level, how our tax structure works in the severance arena, mainly for our oil, which is what we commonly refer to as our oil tax structure. And it is one of the most complex in the world, and that's no exaggeration. And some of us feel it's far too complex. So we're going to have a presentation. We're going to walk through it and look at FY22 and FY23. And then tomorrow we're going to have our consultant, Gaffney Klein, here, and we're going to talk about the competitive position of our basin to other oil basins around the world. So this is kind of a precluder for tomorrow's meeting. So with that, Mr. Stickle, if you could introduce yourself for the record and take us through the presentation. We'll do our normal order where we pause at the end of every slide for discussions, questions, and if we happen to jump forward on a question that may be better answered in more detail in upcoming slides, we will just let us know. We'll wait till we get to that slide and then go into detail. And with that, Mr. Stickle, if you could explain to us how we get our net revenue here at the table to pay our bills.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, I'm the Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to come and present the Order of Operations presentation today. So the purpose of the presentation is really to provide a very high-level overview of how the oil and gas production tax works for the North Slope. This will be a refresher for many of the members of the committee, but also good as a refresher and for, you know, any of the folks watching at home who are less familiar with the production tax to really understand at a high level how it works. So slide 2 is a list of acronyms that we use in the presentation. I try to minimize the use of abbreviations and acronyms as much as possible, but given the complexity and the technical aspect of the tax system, sometimes acronyms are unavoidable, so we included this slide as a reference for folks as we go through the presentation.
So when you walk through your presentation, try not to use the acronyms as much as possible. I know it's very easy for us to get into finance and speak here at the table, but we really want to make sure the folks at home don't have to be thinking about what the acronym is if we just take a couple of minutes and lay it out. I'll try to help remind you and vice versa. Sometimes I will flip into the acronym also because it's what we normally use amongst ourselves.
Understood. So for the order of the presentation, again, the purpose is really to explain the nuts and bolts of the production tax and the fiscal system that we have now, what we have currently and how it works, not getting into the policy of whether any of these provisions are good or bad, but just to really build the foundational understanding of how the current system does work. So we'll start by looking at all of the sources of oil and gas revenue to the state, and then we'll move on to a detailed walkthrough of the production tax in particular. Again, the focus will be on the North Slope oil piece of the production tax, as that's where the vast majority of the state's revenue comes from oil and gas.
Okay, maybe before you go to that next slide, to your comment about today's more of a mechanical discussion, what we actually have. Tomorrow we'll be going into the, is this policy a good policy? What's the strength? What's the weaknesses? Things like that, and probably excruciating detail depending on the particular area. So I just want to let people know that those type of discussions will be tomorrow. And today we want to make sure we understand what we actually have. And it might be pointed out that some of the areas that we have questions, concerns, weaknesses, or what we feel is a strength or something. But so these two meetings today and tomorrow kind of go together.
Understood. So moving on to slide four, kind of a disclaimer as we go through the presentation, we are attempting to take a very complex tax system and break it down into easily understandable pieces. Most of the data presented in here is aggregated among all of the companies doing business on the slope, so it's not going to, it's aggregated data. When we do our official revenue forecast, we are modeling on a company-specific basis, so just something to point out. Also, I'm an economist, not an auditor, so to disclaim, anything I say is not an official tax interpretation.
So explain to me a little bit more when you say it's an aggregated numerics that we work here at the table. Give me more detail on that, and sure, how that actually works.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So there's multiple producers and companies doing business in the state. We have a few major producers on the North Slope. When we do our official revenue forecast, we're actually modeling each individual producer's tax liability using confidential information that we have for each producer. Due to the confidentiality provisions in state statute, we're not allowed to release any information that would identify the particulars of a taxpayer. So when we're presenting information to the legislature and the public, we're aggregating the information from all of these companies together into a single set of numbers.
So you take their weekly, monthly, daily data, roll it all up into the individual corporations, I think it's dominated by three, and then consolidate those monthly data, what have you, into annual and give the legislature one number. And that's what we have to set our policy with. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So the challenge we have is it doesn't necessarily reflect any individual company. And in many circumstances, we have looked at changes or concerns are brought to us with our tax structure that may benefit one company, the other company may be neutral, and the other company thinks it's a horrible idea. And we have to set the policy for the basin or the state, and it makes it impossible for us to make a consolidated policy that all of the producers are going to like all the time, or more even most of the time, because there's differences amongst the companies. Is that not correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Each company has a different portfolio of operations and a different cost structure, and so the impacts of a given policy will vary somewhat between companies.
Correct. So I'm just trying to set the stage a little bit why there's, why we have so much discussion on this over the years. So we'll go on and through the slide number five.
Sure. So slide number five is just a description of the four primary sources of oil and gas revenue to the state. So there is a royalty. The state receives a royalty for production on state land, as well as a shared royalty for production on federal land. And towards the end of the presentation, I have a slide that describes how the royalty provisions differ for all the different forms of state land, of land in the state. We have a corporate income tax, which is based on worldwide net income of the corporation apportioned to Alaska. This applies to many but not all of the companies operating in the state. We have a property tax, which applies to all property anywhere in the state and within the state's 3-mile limit offshore. And then the production tax, which is the primary focus of today's presentation, this applies to any production within the state and within the three-mile limit, regardless of the ownership of the land.
Okay, and being a two-handed economist, can you explain to the committee why we have a royalty and what it is, and a production tax and what it is, and why we just don't have tax X, or why do we have these two components, or is there a difference between them, other than the mechanical tax structure?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So royalty conceptually is the payment to the landowner. So the state of Alaska, when the state of Alaska is a landowner, we will lease that land to companies who will go out and spend the money and make the investments to develop the oil and gas on that land. The companies will pay typically pay an upfront bonus bid for the initial right to do the exploration and development. They'll pay an ongoing rental for the use of that land. And then as production comes out of the ground, they'll pay a royalty interest. And typically that royalty interest will be set at the time that the leases are issued. So for most leases on state land, the royalty is 12.5%. There are some at the 16.67%. But that's the revenue that the state receives for its landowner interest on that land. The production tax is a more general tax for the privilege of producing oil and gas in the state of Alaska generally.
So the royalty is by contract?
That's correct.
And we don't change the contract here at this table. But we do have policy discussions and modifications on the production tax, correct?
That's correct.
All right, so just as a reminder for people watching why we don't change royalties, we have contracts, royalty contracts that go back to the opening, to the 60s, or maybe even longer, who knows. But we have the original royalty contracts in place, and I think those are even transferable. And the new participant in the oil basin after BP left, those royalties weren't renegotiated and adjusted, but they were transferred or what have you to the new operator?
I believe that's the case, Mr. Chairman. I'm not the expert on the nuanced provisions of royalty contracts, but that sounds correct.
Yep, okay. Go on to the next slide.
So slide 6 shows all the sources of state revenue from oil and gas from fiscal year 2020 up through our forecast of fiscal year 2024. So there's a 5-year comparison here. A couple notes on these numbers. The property tax revenues here are the state share of property tax revenues. In addition, there's a municipal, a much larger number in the $400 to $500 million range each year that goes to municipalities. The corporate income tax, which is shown here, this corporate tax applies only to C corporations. There are some temporary impacts that you see in the revenue for fiscal year 2020 and 2021. This relates to the low oil prices that we had and some federal tax changes related to the COVID-19 Recovery Act. Production tax, which is the focus of our presentation here. On the royalty information, this includes bonuses, rents, and interest. This includes both the state's unrestricted general fund share of royalties as well as the constitutionally dedicated share of royalties that goes to the permanent fund and the school fund. A couple other sources of revenue that we get from oil and gas are settlements to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So based on any assessments or disputes of prior year's production tax, royalty, or other oil and gas or minerals taxes, by constitution, any revenue received from those settlements is deposited to the Budget Reserve Fund. And then finally, the last category is shared revenue from the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, or NPRA. This is the 50% share of any bonuses, rents, interest, and royalties that the federal government receives for production in the petroleum reserve. That's shared with the state, but there are special restrictions around how that money can be used by the state. It's been a fairly small revenue source historically, but as additional production in the petroleum reserve comes online, we do expect this to be a bigger revenue source in the future.
So on the NPRA, the National Petroleum Reserve A, don't those royalties just basically flow through the state and to the impacted local communities in the area?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. So the state administers a grant program to direct that revenue to impacted communities on the North Slope.
Okay. Any questions on the top structure? Okay.
And so one final note, this seemed like a good place to make this note. So the revenue numbers in the presentation are looking at current law and current year tax liabilities and fiscal impacts. There is another issue out there of tax credits left over from the prior tax regime and available for state purchase. There's about $565 million of outstanding tax credits available for state purchase as of January 1st of this year. That's kind of a separate issue, and in this presentation we're not addressing that outstanding liability for the prior tax credits, but wanted to just mention that for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. And on that, I had spoken with Mr. Stickle yesterday on that issue and asked him to try to delineate that out so it's clear to see the flow of the tax structure in any given year. And then we've got accrued liabilities in the past that come in that we have to service. Here, it's $555 million, and I think previously at the committee we were using a rough number of 700. So I guess the 555 is more accurate, and we'll be having a discussion coming up in the operating budget of the numeric to use to pay down that liability. But I thought it would be much more accurate to delineate those, because the concern is if you take that 555 and you count it this year as a credit against our revenue and we don't pay it, say hypothetically we don't pay any, which I'm not advocating, but as an example, then next year when we do this similar presentation, we'd be counting that 555 again, and it would distort what actually is going on. So we just need to remember when we look through 22 and FY23, particularly FY23, that 555 is sitting on the sidelines ready for an appropriation. So we just want to clarify that. It's to minimize the confusion for everybody, public and the committee and the whole legislature. They're different, separate issues. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I had, maybe he already answered. I didn't quite hear what you said about what was the total of the tax credit liability that was $555 million?
Senator Olson, through the chair, the number I quoted was $565 million. That was a number that we had submitted in a letter as of January 1st of this year. The number in the fall revenue forecast was $587 million.
I can continue, Mr. Chairman. And that includes what's owed to the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation as well. Is that part of this $565 million roughly?
Senator Olson, through the chair, that would include all outstanding credits available for state purchase.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And could you, because we're on the subject, help the committee a little bit with how the credits work? Because I think it can be traded, this liability issue. They can be traded amongst companies themselves. It can be put to the Treasury. There's some maneuvering that goes around. So that number changes from time to time. So could you help us with that before we move on to?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So these you know, these outstanding credits, again, which are no longer available to earn new credits available for state purchase, the credits can be certificated. So the state will issue a tax credit certificate. The company can then, if a company has production and sufficient tax liability, they can use that credit to offset their tax liability. They can request state purchase and get in, basically you get in line to get paid. Since we haven't, prior to fiscal year 2016, the state actually purchased the full outstanding balance of eligible tax credits every year. But since then, we've been purchasing less than the full balance, so you can put in that request and get on the list to have your credit purchased. A company can also transfer or assign these credits. So in some cases, the outstanding credits have been assigned to a financial entity who has, you know, provided financing in exchange for the right to the tax credit certificate. They can be transferred to an existing producer, and that has happened in some cases where a company will sell their credit, often at a discount to face value, to another company who will then use that credit to apply against a tax liability.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding, Mr. Stickle, that the ASRC tax credit situation they find themselves in, they don't have the ability to go ahead and either trade, sell, or use them toward a tax liability. Is that true?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm really not prepared to speak to the specifics of a particular taxpayer and what credits they might have.
But some of them are different. Is that correct? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Senator Olson, through the chair, there were some changes. There have been various changes made to the tax credit provisions over the years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions.
So when you say they can be assigned, so in English, that means a bank could pick them up, or we're not talking about Guido. We're talking about a lending institution or something like that?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. So a lot of, you know, several of these companies, given that the state was purchasing the full value of tax credits prior to fiscal year 2016, many of these companies planned on that being the case going forward. And so they had built in, you know, the ability to monetize these credits into their, you know, their ongoing plans for financing their company. And so in the absence of the state purchasing the credits, they've gone and assigned these credits to a lending institution. And so that's allowed the companies to get the financing that they need to continue their work. And now the credits are actually held by the lending institution. And so when the state ultimately purchases the tax credits, we would that money would flow through to the lending institution.
Okay. We have any other questions on this one before we go on to, I guess, number seven, slide seven?
All right. Slide seven is just a graphic that shows the overall order in which the elements of the fiscal system are applied. So royalties come first. That's the revenue that accrues to the owner of the land, and they get that share right off the top before any taxes are calculated. Property tax is second. State and local property taxes for the upstream portion are actually considered lease expenditures for calculating production tax, and for downstream expenditures are considered they flow through into the transportation cost calculation for production tax.
And what does downstream mean?
So, Mr. Chairman, the term upstream and downstream really kind of delineates activity on the lease versus off the lease. So in the oil field where the oil is being produced, the wells are being drilled, all the activities taking place, that's considered upstream of the point of production. And then midstream is the transportation infrastructure. So like, for instance, the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and then downstream is kind of the end result of that oil going into a refinery and ultimate distribution to the end user.
Okay, so upstream's the wellhead or where it bubbles out of the ground.
Correct.
If you were Jed Clampett.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. So when I use the term upstream, we're referring to upstream of the point of production.
Okay.
On the lease. So production tax is calculated after royalties, and it does allow property tax as a deduction. And then after production tax comes state corporate income tax. Again, uses worldwide income as part of the tax base. And that worldwide income calculation excludes the property tax and production tax and royalties in its calculation. And then finally, federal corporate income tax is the last piece of the fiscal system. All state taxes, including the state corporate income tax, are deductible in calculating the federal corporate income tax.
Okay, next slide.
So slide 8 is the beginning of our production tax discussion. So the table has quite a lot going on, and what I'm going to do is kind of unpack this table step by step over a series of several slides. This is based on the income statement presentation, for which is an illustration of the production tax calculation. We include that in Appendix E of the Revenue Sources book. And it walks through, as on this slide, walks through the illustration of the production tax calculation for fiscal year 2023 in particular. So we start with our fall revenue forecast, which is an average oil price of $71 per barrel and a forecast of 500.2 thousand barrels per day of daily production. That calculates out to an annual number of barrels of just over 182 million barrels of oil production with a value of about $13 billion. And then over the next several slides, we'll focus on how that $13 billion is ultimately split and taxed. And again, just to note that this is an aggregation of the tax calculation. The actual taxes are based on monthly filings and calendar year returns for all the different producers.
You ready for the next slide?
Sure. So walking through the income statement, we'll start at the top with slide 9. Step 1 is calculating the taxable barrels, which are subject to the production tax. Any royalty barrels are subtracted regardless of the owner of those barrels. So the typical rates are 1/8, which is the 12.5%, or 1/6, which is the 16.67%, but the rates do vary. In addition to the state royalty, any federal and private land royalty barrels are also subtracted here in calculating the taxable barrels. Also, any barrels that are not subject to taxation would also be subtracted here. This would include a small portion of production beyond the state's 3-mile limit. Currently, there's a small portion of production at the North Star field that falls into that category. Potential future developments like the Liberty field would also fall into that category. And so after subtracting those royalty barrels, we arrive at about 160 million taxable barrels for fiscal year 2023 with a total value of $11.4 billion.
Okay.
Slide 10 moves on to calculating the gross value at point of production. This is also called the wellhead value, and again, this is where we talk about the upstream is anything that happens before this wellhead gross value of point of production. Transportation costs, known as netback costs, are subtracted from the total taxable value to arrive at the gross value at point of production. So we start with the oil sale, which in our forecast is $71 per barrel on the west coast of the United States. Typically, that's going to be Long Beach is where the price is actually assessed at, is Long Beach, California delivery. We deduct all of the transportation costs of getting to that in delivery, so the marine transportation costs, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff, any feeder pipelines to get to the beginning of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff, and then there's some other miscellaneous deductions. So subtracting those transportation costs gets to an average wellhead value or value at point of production of $61.91 per barrel for fiscal year 2023 with an average, with a total value of about $9.9 billion.
So help me a little bit with the, you know, the downstream costs. We've talked about not all oil is equal in that it has different severance tax issues or possibly royalty issues, but pretty much all the oil off the North Slope is going to have to come down through that pipeline. And so talk a little bit about this $9.09, which is your tariff, moving your oil down the pipeline and then across your tankers, across the ocean.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So what we're trying to do here is understand what is the value of the oil when it leaves the lease on the North Slope. And there is no, there's not a posted price for that value at the oil. So the way that we derive that value in the tax calculation is we do what's called a net back. And so we start with the sale of the oil at the destination, which is typically on the west coast of the United States, and then we net back all of the different costs to get to an assumed value at the lease. And so that's where we say, you know, we take that end value, and there is a public assessment for that end value on the west coast. So in this case, we're assuming the $71 per barrel on the west coast. And then we're saying, what are all of the costs of getting the oil from the lease to the West Coast? And so we do allow them to deduct the cost for the any of the pipelines, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and then the tanker costs of getting it to market.
Okay, Senator Bishop and Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, it's good to see you. As an economist, in your opinion, if we were producing 800,000 barrels a day, would you anticipate that downstream cost would go down?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, yes. So some of the costs are fairly constant on a per barrel basis. There are some of the downstream costs, for instance, the operation of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. There's many costs of operating the pipeline that are incurred regardless of how many barrels are going down the pipeline. And so if there were more barrels going down the pipeline, the average cost on a per barrel basis would be lower. And we've actually seen this to some extent in recent years where production has stabilized and so has the transportation cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that was one of the arguments that was made when the More Alaska Production Act was passed. We were told that we were going to get 1 million barrels of oil per day, and it was going to lower the downstream tariffs, and then we'd make more money. And unfortunately, we're, according to this, roughly half of our 1 million barrels that we were promised. That said, the 909 in downstream transportation costs, what percentage of that is costs for pipelines in Alaska, and who are the major pipeline owners?
So, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the detail I have available right now on the 909 is that breaks out to $3.47 per barrel marine costs, $4.98 per barrel forecasted tariff for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, 56 cents per barrel for feeder pipeline tariffs, a 7 cent per barrel adjustment in the other direction for quality bank adjustments, and then 15 cents per barrel for other adjustments, which includes pipeline and tanker gains and losses primarily. And this information is coming from Appendix B1 of the Revenue Sources book.
And then who owns TAPS, or the Trans-Alaska Pipeline? I think that was part of his question. Who owns the tankers? How is that system structured?
Sure, Senator Wilkowski, Mr. Chair. So the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is operated by a independent third party, which is the major oil companies do share ownership in that third party company that operates the pipeline.
And the tankers also?
So, yes, Mr. Chairman. So some of the producers own their own tankers, other producers charter tankers.
Okay. Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a regulated return on the downstream costs? And if so, what is that regulated return?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, yes, there's all sorts of regulations surrounding these transportation costs. I don't have the rate of return off the top of my head. We can provide that.
Okay, you can get back to the committee on that structure. I know we've had, the state's had disagreements with some of the tariff structures, and we've had court cases and settlements and numerous times. So, yeah, getting back to us, that'll be good. Senator Wilkowski, another follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and my understanding is it's, I don't know, anywhere from 10 to 14% regulated return, but I look forward to that number. But what's the rationale for allowing, so the oil companies own the pipeline service, own the transportation service, they're getting a regulated return. So they're making a profit on the transportation of this, and then they're able to then deduct that, even though they're making a profit, off the taxable rate. What's the rationale for that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, so I mean, this is a kind of a typical approach, you know, worldwide, is that we're not taxing the oil in California when it's sold at Long Beach. We're attempting to tax the value of the oil that comes out of the ground on the North Slope. So absent a market price for oil coming out of the ground on the North Slope, we need to have some way of coming up with that valuation of what is the oil worth on the North Slope when it comes out of the ground. And so this net back approach is the way that we've chosen to arrive at that calculation.
And that's by contract, I assume?
So, Mr. Chairman, the net back calculation is laid out in statute for production tax. I believe it's specified in contract for royalty. There's similar approach used in royalty calculations.
Okay. Senator Olson, did you have a question? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. You briefly touched on it. I think it was 7 cents, but can you go back to the quality bank? Is that right?
Sure, Senator Bishop. So there's what's known as a quality bank. This is a financial accounting that is done for any pipelines. So the basic issue here is that each oil field on the North Slope has a slightly different quality of oil. And then when some oil is slightly higher quality, higher value than others. When those go into the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, all the oil is mixed together. And then at the end of the pipeline, when the oil comes out and goes on a tanker, you know, each producer gets oil that has, it may or may not be the same oil that they put into the pipeline. And so there's a quality bank, which is basically a financial mechanism for a producer to pay or be compensated for the differences in the oil that they put into the pipeline versus took out of the pipeline. Also, along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, there's a refinery, and if a refinery takes oil out of the pipeline, those refineries are actually, they're kind of high grading a little bit, so they're producing higher value end products, and so the net oil that comes out at the end of the pipeline is a slightly lower quality than the oil that went in at the top of the pipeline. And so those refineries also pay into the quality bank. And so the 7 cents per barrel is our forecast of the increase to the value that accrues to the producers based on that refinery impact.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Any other questions on slide number 10? Okay, we'll speed along to operating costs and capital costs.
Sure. So, yeah, moving on to slide 11. So the production tax is essentially a modified net profit tax in that we do allow companies to deduct their expenses in calculating their tax value. For capital expenditures, we generally define those using guidelines from the Internal Revenue Service to define what is a capital expense. There is no depreciation required for capital expense in the production tax. A company can immediately deduct all capital expenditures incurred. And then for operating expenditures, these are any allowable expenses that are not a capital expense. Typically, this is going to be the ongoing cost of operations and labor. So two terms to explain here are allowable and deductible lease expenditures. So allowable lease expenditures are generally any cost in the unit that's directly associated with producing the oil. Not all costs are allowable, and this is something that an oil company will make sure to mention. Examples of some costs that are not allowable at all in the production tax calculation include any financing costs, lease acquisition costs, costs of dispute resolution, dismantlement, removal, and restoration costs. And then the other term that we use is deductible lease expenditures. This is a term that, it's a term of art that we've kind of created in Department of Revenue. It's not used in any statute or regulation, but the deductible lease expenditures refers to that portion of the allowable lease expenditures that are applied in the tax calculation in a given year. And then the non-deductible lease expenditures would be any allowable expenses beyond a company's gross value that are not deducted against the tax calculation in a given year. Those non-deductible lease expenditures turn into carry forward losses. And you can see at the bottom of the slide here, we're forecasting that there's about $681 million of lease expenditures that will be made in fiscal year 2023 and not deducted in the tax calculation, and those would turn into a carry forward.
So those are smaller companies, basically, or companies that don't have production, most likely not one of the big three, I assume, generally speaking, and those are expenditures that they have incurred, but they have no revenue because they're not pumping any oil, and then they're allowed to carry them forward and deduct them when they do actually produce oil?
Mr. Chairman, that's accurate. So the carried forward lease expenditures benefit would be available to any company, but given the price forecast that we have in the forecast, we expect that this is primarily going to be those companies that are not existing producers and are making significant investments in exploration and development of future production.
And then help me a little bit. Can they carry them forward forever? Can they, trade them off to Company X next door so he can deduct them? Give me a little more structure on how that $681 million is handled.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So those the carry forward lease expenditures cannot be transferred to another company. They're held by the company that earned them until they come into production, and then they can apply those against a future tax liability. The carry forward lease expenditures, they belong to a specific year earned, and beginning with the 8th or 11th year after those are earned, the lease expenditures would, if they haven't been applied, they would reduce in value by 10% each year.
So there's a trigger out in front, you said 8 to 11 years out, depending on the circumstances, and then they start ratcheting down going forward till they disappear.
Mr. Chairman, so the way the hair we call it a downlift, but the way the 10% reduction works is it's based on the prior year's ending value, so the value of the lease expenditures would never fully disappear. They just reduce by 10% of the prior value every year into perpetuity if they're not used.
Okay. Any other questions on this? This could be a significant amount going forward in some of our projections if we get some expansion on the slope. Isn't that correct? That we could be facing $1 billion or carry forwards or some number?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. So to the extent that there are significant investments made in future production by new entrants, there would be a significant outstanding value of these carried forward lease expenditures. And in the revenue sources book on table 8.4, we actually include a projection of the tax value of those future lease expenditures. And there is the projection is that the tax value of those will exceed $1 billion.
And then help me with, because you're an economist, two arm economists, help me with why we even have or offer the ability to carry it forward. And is this a standard practice or just to Alaska? And why do we have that? And if we didn't have it, what would potentially be the, you know, at a high level, the impact or the effect?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So allowing companies to recoup their costs is very much a standard practice in oil and gas fiscal systems around the world, as I'm sure you'll hear from the consultants tomorrow. If we did not allow for lease expenditures to be carried forward and only allowed for lease expenditures to be deducted by a company with current revenue, I think you would see a lot less. The incentive would be for a lot less investment by new entrants and to really concentrate the investment by existing companies.
Okay, so let me put a finer point, then we'll go to Senator Wilikowski, because this is an issue we need to pay attention to. So we've spent quite a bit of time, and we'll probably spend some time tomorrow, talking about timings of cash flow and when an investor, or oil company, whatever, sinks a significant amount of money over a period of 4 or 5 years to get to production, then there's the revenue stream after production, theoretically, in the black, for them to return their capital and get a rate of return on their investment to do another one, because they're not up there for Jesus. They're up there for a reason, because it's a business. So if we didn't allow the deductibility of expenditures, it would significantly change your cash flow models and their time value of money calculations and to the negative, and make it very difficult to have a project that would be economic. And we've spent quite a bit of time here moving that cash flow timing back or bringing it forward to allow earlier cash flow positive to the company to enhance its rate of return, thereby getting the result we want, which is production. And we have had a lot of presentations and consultants talk to us about the significance of small changes, sometimes bigger changes, but changing in time the cash flow. Bring it forward, it's much more attractive. Push it out 10, 20, 25 years, it's a lot less attractive and harder to compete with other basins and or even get to a positive final investment decision. So that's kind of the high-level structure. I was hoping you'd hit on that, but that's okay. So then there's a concern about when you generate these losses, what can you take those losses against geographically? And can you talk about that? Because that's another issue, and then we'll go to Senator Wilikowski's question or questions.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the carried forward loss provision is currently available for the North Slope. It's also available for Middle Earth. We're not forecasting significant investment there.
So let's stop there for a minute. So we're not going to the center of the planet, right? We're not going to put an oil well in the core of the Earth. So tell us what Middle Earth is.
We're not quoting Tolkien here. So there's two primary oil and gas basins in the state of Alaska. There's the North Slope oil and gas, and then there's the oil and gas produced around Cook Inlet. There's a separate tax regime for anything outside the North Slope and Cook Inlet, and colloquially we do refer to that as Middle Earth, since it's in the middle of the two primary basins. But so for any carried forward lease expenditures earned on the North Slope, those can only be applied against North Slope production. And in fact, there's a provision where to utilize the carried forward lease expenditure, you also have to come into production to utilize that.
Okay, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that allowing carry forward, allowing these expenses to be carried forward is pretty common around the world. How many other states in the United States oil tax regimes allow for carry forward of these type expenses?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, so I wouldn't have the exact number off the top of my head. What I can say generally is most of the other states in the United States have a less sophisticated tax regime. Most of those tax regimes are based on a gross, simply taxing the gross value at a lower tax rate. Our tax regime is really more directly comparable to other countries around the world.
Okay, so let's stop there for a second, because we're different, right? Maybe we look different, or we talk different, or we're just geographically different. So why are we different from Texas and North Dakota, and who owns the subsurface?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So in Alaska, the state does own the subsurface rights to most of the oil and gas production. In most other states, the private landowners own a significant share of the land ownership. Also, in terms of the nature of the oil fields, Prudhoe Bay is a world-class oil field, and we have a world-class oil basin, which is very different from the type of production that's dominating in some of the other states now, where they're doing the shale oil production. It's just a different type of oil production, and a different type of land ownership. And as I'm sure you'll hear from the consultants, the most direct comparison for our production tax and competitiveness really is with other oil producing countries and some of the other world-class oil basins around the world.
Correct. So that's something that we got to remember. Most of the other regimes, or I should say states, the farmer or the rancher owns the subsurface, and they have, quite frankly, they have quite a bit higher royalties and other structures, but we'll be going into that tomorrow. Why there's a difference in Alberta. Their sovereign owns the subsurface. So we are different, and that's one reason why we have a structure that looks so different. So you got to be very careful when we compare the Permian Basin in Texas or North Dakota directly against the state and Alaska. So we're going to have some of that in detail tomorrow and look at that. So there is differences. We'll get a finer point on that answer tomorrow, Senator Wilikowski, and follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
I do. Thank you. A lot to unpack there. So, so when you testified that most places around the world allow carry forwards, in reality, actually there are no states in the United States that allow carry forwards. Is that correct?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I'm not.
Let's leave that question to the consultants, because again, we're the only state in the union owns the subsurface. We're not going to compare directly with that, but we'll go into that tomorrow, because you got to add up all of our components, sales tax, property tax, corporate income tax, or loss of it, royalties, severance, insert, and to get some comparison. So that's coming tomorrow. I haven't looked at those presentations, but I think we're the only one with a production sharing contract structure or alterations of that structure also in the country. Follow up?
Yeah. I don't. You talked about differences and how comparing Alaska to other places. You said we're a world class basin. If we're a world class basin, why are we getting roughly half the royalties and taxes that they get in Texas and North Dakota? If we were a world class basin, shouldn't we be getting at least the same amount of royalties and taxes that they get in Texas and North Dakota? And shouldn't we be producing more than half of what they are currently producing?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, those are policy questions, and the intent of this presentation is to walk through the nuts and bolts of how the current production tax system works.
I think we're going to be asking that question tomorrow in the comparisons. And that in the preceding question that was asked is the transferability of our royalty contracts. The royalty contracts were signed decades and decades ago and are very, very valuable, because the royalty structure significantly changed in the last 60 years. And we'll be asking those questions also. So we need to take that into account. Again, but it all boils down to the net cash at the table. And there is concern by some members, Senator Wilikowski expressed that, as far as is the sharing relationship fair or on par or problematic or what have you relative to other basins. So that's tomorrow we'll be going into those discussions. So we're trying to keep on the mechanics, but when we get off of that, we'll just try to remember those questions or roll down the table tomorrow, because the consultant tomorrow is here to answer those questions. Senator Wilikowski.
I understand that, and I understand that the presenter is here as an economist. However, I think he sort of waded into some policy areas and made some statements which I think made a portrayal which is not, I would say, completely accurate. If you compare Alaska, if you want to compare Alaska to the lower 48, we can do that. If you want to compare Alaska to other profit-sharing countries, we can do that as well. And what you'll find is, in Nori, for example, they allow 100% recoupment, just like we do, but then they tax at 78%. In countries like Iraq, they allow 100% recoupment, and then they tax at, say, 99%. What you find in Alaska is we allow 100% recoupment, and we have a gross tax of $4.63 on $71 barrel oil, which is 6.5%. It is the lowest tax rate probably in the world. And so I just think it's important, Mr. Chairman, that this be presented in an objective way and not trying to slant it to make our tax structure seem like it's some sort of, it's trying to incentivize production, or it's somehow good for the state. It's terrible for the state. This has been a horrific policy. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to work on those things, but the point that was put on the table to compare to North Dakota and Texas, that's one comparative group. over the years, we've spent more time looking at Alberta and the North Sea and other areas. But we'll have, I think, all of those type of comparisons to actually try to get a good feel for our basin. And the comment about the size of the basin, the North Slope's the largest conventional oil field in North America, without a doubt. It is a significant asset. We're not going to run out of oil or gas for the foreseeable future. There is little to no chance, in my opinion, of that field ever being shut down. So, or the state putting in policies that shut it down. So it's a significant asset, very, very valuable for us and our future Alaskans, no doubt about it. And we're going to talk about some of those scales. It's not as big as oil sands in Alberta, and it's not as big as Venezuela's oil fields, but it still is significant. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, just to kind of boil it all down to what the net take that goes to the state with the complicated formula that is out there, as well as compared to some of the simpler formulas that are there that would be easier to audit, say, I guess, what's the bottom line? Do we get more or less out of the complicated system, or if we had a more simplified system?
Senator Olson, through the chair, that's a nuanced question.
I mean, if the person on the street was asking the question, why don't we just have a simple system like this? What way would you have a more net back to the state?
Again, we're rolling into policy issues. You know, we're trying to go through the structure. We haven't even got down to the money yet.
Okay.
We'll get down to the money, and then we'll talk about the money. Okay. Is that okay?
I just wondered if there was just a simple answer.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think if you pay it, you think it's high, and if you receive it, you think it's low. That just put a little humor at the table. But if we can go on, Mr. Stickle, we have any other questions on the least expenditures? Because we are going to go into that tomorrow, and Senator Wilikowski's questions and concerns and interest in ring fencing is another subject where we have areas that are restricted into where they can deduct against others. So, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. On the lease expenditures, are any of these lease expenditures being allowed for fields for which the state will receive no royalties or very little taxes in the future?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So the lease expenditures are allowed to be deducted for any activity within the area that the state levies the production tax, which is any activity on state land or within the state's 3-mile limit.
So that'll be on the last slide, and that is a point of concern and question, that the incentives that are offered are offered to lands where revenue can be received. I think that's the point of the question, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, the question is, are we allowing the industry to write off of their taxes fields expenses for which we're not going to get any royalties or taxes? Are there fields for which we won't get any royalties that we're letting them write off?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, and again, this is detailed later in the presentation, the state receives some tax or royalty benefit for all production on state land and within the 3-mile limit. The exact nature of that benefit and the amount of the royalty received depends on the landowner, but the state does receive some tax or royalty benefit from all of that production.
So we have that on the last slide, and that's something we're going to go in with a consultant tomorrow, because that is a concern in the magnitude, especially as we go forward and develop other areas outside of state ownership. So let's go on then to slide 12. We'll get done at on time, so I'll watch the clock.
Excellent. So slide 12, now that we've figured out our lease expenditures, excuse me. This is where we get to production tax value. You'll see it abbreviated as PTV. The production tax value is the gross value at point of production less the deductible lease expenditures. And this is basically the net profit proxy that we use for levying the production tax. Each company calculates its production tax value based on all of their North Slope activity, including all fields and developments, including new developments. And this is essentially the tax base for the production tax.
Okay, so we'll go into the next one, and now we're going to get into the two-step tax structure here, so we'll try to keep them straight. And I've, if you can take us through slide 13 and why you have two selections here, please.
Sure. So slide 13, so there's two primary calculations that are done in the production tax calculation. There's the net tax levy, and then there's a gross minimum tax floor. It's not a true tax levy, it's a floor calculation. The minimum tax floor is 4% of gross value when annual oil prices are greater than $25 per barrel. There are lower percentages for the floor if the annual oil price were to be less than $25 per barrel. For fiscal year 23, the minimum tax floor of 4% multiplied by the gross value at point of production of $9.9 billion gets us to a minimum tax floor of $396.7 million.
Okay, and a little confusing. You look at the tax rates, 4 and 35, but they're two, one's on gross, one's on net, so just don't extrapolate them straight across for those watching the slide behind me. Okay, you want to talk a little bit about or how you plan on handling the switch between the two? Is that on your next slide?
Sure, yeah, Mr. Chairman. So a couple slides down, we kind of talk about the calculation of the tax. And
okay, we'll go to 14 if there's no questions on 13.
Sure, so slide 14 just has some bullet points describing the gross value of the gross value reduction. This is an incentive for investment in new developments. This was part of the Senate Bill 21 tax reform that was passed in 2013. The gross value reduction provides a temporary benefit used to reduce the value of oil subject to tax for new fields. It excludes 20 or 30% of the gross value of oil from the production tax value calculation for up to 7 years of production for a new field. So the benefit expires after 7 years, or if there's 3 years of in which the oil price exceeded $70 per barrel, then the gross value reduction would expire early. It's available exclusively for fields that that are including only state-issued leases with greater than 12.5% royalty.
So if I heard you correctly, the gross value reduction is available only for the newer leases, because the newer ones are the higher ones, the 16 versus the 12.5. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. So to qualify for the gross value reduction, a field must be comprised exclusively of state-owned leases or state-issued leases with greater than 12.5% royalty.
Okay. And then I don't think you finished your slide, correct? I jumped in too early.
Sure. So the final bullet point here, gross value reduction eligible oil receives a flat $5 per barrel of taxable production credit. That credit can be used to reduce tax liability below the minimum tax floor for companies that do not choose to utilize the sliding scale credit. And I think in a slide or two, we have some more information on those credits.
So our floor's a little leaky, is what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, as an added benefit for gross value reduction for these new fields, the $5 per barrel tax credit can reduce liability below the floor for some of these new developments.
Okay. Next slide.
So slide 15 is the net tax calculation. The net tax is based on, it's a 35% statutory tax rate applied against the production tax value. For companies with qualifying new production, they are able to reduce their production tax value by the value of that gross value reduction. So for fiscal year 2023, applying, we have an estimated $5.7 billion of production tax value after the gross value reduction multiplied times the statutory 35% tax rate gives a tax before credits of about $2 billion. And again, that's the tax before application of any tax credits.
So we got a 35% tax rate. That's the statutory rate. So what's the effective rate?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the effective rate is going to be a little bit less than that. So typically the way we show an effective tax rate is we look at the total tax paid to the state divided by the production tax value.
So can you get back to the committee on that? Because I think it's significantly different than 35%.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So mental math here, it's somewhere between 10 and 20%.
Okay. But if you could maybe get back to the committee on that, you can use this table and just walk down it. And the per barrel deduction, when we get into the slider, talk about the slider a little bit. What's going on there?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. That gets to the next slide if we're done with slide 15.
Okay.
So slide 16 addresses tax credits against liability. The two major tax credits are the per taxable barrel credits. There's one for gross value reduction eligible oil and one for all other oil. The vast majority of production right now is the non-gross value reduction eligible oil. That could change in future years as new fields come online. For most production that's non-GV, non-gross value reduction eligible, there's a sliding scale credit. It ranges from $0 to $8 per taxable barrel. The zero sliding scale credit applies when the wellhead value of oil is greater than $150 per barrel. And for each $10 of oil, there's a change in the value of the credit, and the $8 per barrel credit applies when the wellhead value is less than $80 per taxable barrel of oil. The sliding scale per taxable barrel credit cannot be used to reduce the tax below the minimum tax floor. That's a hard floor for that sort of production. And so companies claiming that credit cannot pay below the minimum tax floor under any circumstance. For gross value reduction eligible production, there is a flat $5 per barrel tax credit per barrel of taxable production, and that credit can be used to reduce tax below the minimum floor, providing that the company does not apply any sliding scale credits. A note on these credits, any per taxable barrel credits not used in the year earned are forfeited. Those can't be repurchased. Those can't be transferred. Those can't be carried forward. So it's a use it or lose it credit. Given the current pricing of $71 per barrel oil, we are forecasting that companies will be able to utilize nearly all of the credits generated. So for fiscal year 2023, we're forecasting $1.25 billion of per taxable barrel credits generated, and nearly all of that will be deducted in the tax calculation. There's some other tax credits against liability. These are relatively minor fiscal impact, but these include any prior year credits earned and held by the companies, as well as there's a small producer credit that's currently phasing out, but we do have a couple companies that are still claiming that.
Senator Willick, are you done with this slide?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Senator Willickowski.
Thank you. Why the non-GVR per barrel, per taxable barrel credits? Why? I thought that was an even number. I thought it went $6, $7, $8. I'm just curious why it's 7.45 and not either 7 or not 8.
Sure, Senator Willickowski, through the chair. So at $71 per barrel oil, companies would generate $8 per barrel per taxable barrel tax credit. Those credits can only be used to reduce tax liability to the gross minimum tax floor. And so while the vast majority of those credits are applied in the tax calculation, there are some companies that are not able to utilize the full $8 per barrel. And so that's where we get to the weighted average that's actually used against tax liability of $7.45 per taxable barrel.
Okay. So I think on the earlier question, we hear the 35% tax quite a bit, but I think our effective rate's down around 13%. So the deductions are significant, and I know there's some concern on the statutory rate of 35 and the per barrel slider from 5 to 8, $5 deductible to $8. And here, with $8, it's almost $1.2 billion in deductions. So there's some concern that that leads to significant distortions over different price ranges and holding us into the minimum tax significantly longer than anticipated when we did these tax changes. And that puts a disadvantage to the state. So there is concern with how that structure works, and we'll talk about that tomorrow with the consultant. But I think we shouldn't be afraid of using the statutory rate at 35 and then using our impacted rate effective rate as we go down the column to see where the impacts are or aren't and which numbers move around. And as I understand, the 8 is the maximum, so now that oil's at 100 or 115 or whatever it is today, significantly higher than it is here projected at 71, that is the top on the per barrel deduction is $8. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So it maxes out. Does that help with your question, Senator Willickowski, on the effective rate? What we're looking at somewhere in the 13% range?
Yeah, I understand. And I'm a little curious, Ms. Chair, as to the discrepancy between the revenue forecast, maybe it's all combined, the per barrel tax credits, it says $1.247 billion Chapter 8, 4. And is that just the combined 1.194 and 53 million? You just combine it all as one?
Sure, Senator Willickowski, through the chair, correct. So looking at table 8.4 of the revenue sources book, on line 11, we do combine the two per taxable barrel credits into one line in the revenue sources book.
Any other questions on this slide? Yeah, slide 17.
So slide 17, now that we've, there's a couple of other items that get added to the total production tax revenue received by the state. There's prior year tax payments or refunds. There's a tax on private landowner royalties. there's any tax on gas produced on the North Slope and any net tax liability from Cook Inlet and other areas of the state. There's some company-specific adjustments. And so we've kind of aggregated all those numbers together here on the chart. And so for fiscal year 2023, the $741.2 million represents the total cash expected into the general fund from the production tax. And then, as we mentioned earlier, there's an additional about $681 million of non-deductible lease expenditures that are expected to be incurred in fiscal year 2023 and carried forward. Those could potentially be applied against a future year tax liability. And the one last note on this bottom line number is that we're showing the general fund revenue impact, so this is not including about $8 million of hazardous release surcharge. That's the nickel per barrel tax on non-royalty barrels. That's considered designated revenue.
And Mr. Stickles has had numerous opportunities over the years and has come into the office to go through these nickels as our numbers, we couldn't match the numbers with the when we compare to the revenue source book, so we walk through that almost every year. I'd like you to, I just want to make a quick note before we go to Senator Wilikowski's question. We have over the years have asked, and this goes back almost 20 years, the department to tell us what the gross revenue in the oil field is. And quite some time ago, almost 20 years, there was a lot of reluctance to even give the Finance Committee that information. And we had worked that out years and years ago. And in this slide, it's showing $12.9 billion in gross stock. And then we worked with the department to show us the flow of deductions to get down to our net number and our actual net number at the table that we have for budgeting purposes. And now, is why we have this slide here showing at $741 million. Because the concern is that the public and the committee know what the gross stock is. What happened to all the money in between that and the net revenue of $741 million? So I do thank the department for always keeping that clear. And it's very helpful, and it helps us with the study. And I want to make another quick point for those watching at home. If oil averages at 100 for FY23, we're going to end up with about $18 billion in gross stock. So these numbers can significantly change between now and when we have Mr. Stickle back in a year, depending on, you know, what's going on with oil prices. But not that I'm hoping for $100 barrel oil, but that's the significance of the dollars. Senator Wilikowski, you had a question.
Chapter table 8.4, again, the production revenue forecast shows $785 million in carry forward credits, and I'm just curious about the discrepancy with the 680.
Sure, Senator Wilikowski through the chair. So looking at line 22 of table 8.4 of the fall 2021 revenue sources book, this is a calculation that estimates the net tax impact of all outstanding carried forward lease expenditures as well as any carried forward credits held by producers. So the $785 million in fiscal year 2023 would take all of those tax credits and lease expenditures that have been carried forward through the end of fiscal year 2023 for all prior years, and assuming that those were offsetting the 35% statutory tax rate, would get to the estimated $785 million tax impact. Looking at the bottom line of slide 17, the $681 million is the total amount of the amount of lease expenditures just for fiscal year 2023 that we are estimating will be incurred in fiscal year 2023 and carried forward. So the $681 million multiplied times the 35% statutory tax rate is embedded into the $785 million in Table 8-4.
Senator Wilkowski.
Okay. And then just looking forward again, Table 8-4 shows that number grows to over $1 billion in 2024 and then grows up to $1.3 billion and within a few years. And what, just to plug in $1 billion for a round number's sake, what would the impact of a net operating loss of $1 billion have on this, the numbers that we're seeing on the state production tax of $741 million, just the rough impact?
Sure, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So companies, these carried forward annual losses at a company's election, they may choose to apply them in their tax liability. They may not reduce their tax liability below the minimum tax floor using these carried forward lease expenditures. So in a hypothetical situation where all of the companies had very large amounts of carried forward annual losses, then we would expect tax to be reduced to the minimum.
So in FY 2023 is the minimum tax would have been, looking for that number, $396 million?
That's correct, Senator Wilkowski.
So we could expect that, are there any net operating or net loss carry forwards calculated into the FY 2023 into this computation here?
Sure, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So we are, our forecast is assuming very minimal impact of prior year carried forward losses. To the extent that we expect any companies to utilize those in their company specific tax calculations, those are incorporated into the forecast. The vast majority of the carried forward losses that are being earned by companies without significant current tax liability. These are companies that are making the large investments in exploration and development of future production.
So I think to Senator Wilkowski's point of the, or concern of carry forwards overwhelming future revenue and or carry forwards coming against the state from areas where we have significantly less revenue potential due to ownership. We'll be talking to and asking the consultant tomorrow on how is that issue dealt with in other regimes, and are there limits on deductibility in any given year to ensure that the sovereign always has, which would be the state, always has cash flow coming in. And that's pretty standard across the globe, so we'll be asking some of those questions tomorrow. Senator Wilkowski.
And in the 10-year production forecast, did the department include the future use of net operating losses, carry forwards? At all?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, in the 10-year revenue forecast, we model each company's expected tax liability. So to the extent that a company is expected to use these are included into the 10-year forecast, yes.
Senator Wilkowski.
Different topic, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We heard a couple weeks ago from Deputy Commissioner Fechter that the administration had done some analysis on lowering the per barrel taxable credits. Were you a part of that analysis?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, our economic research group supports all sorts of analysis. I believe Deputy Commissioner Fechter is online, so that might be a question for him.
Well, let me recant the question and put a little bit of background on it. When we did the oil tax structure, the Senate passed a $5 per barrel credit, and it wasn't a slider. It was fixed. And the House, in their wisdom, added the slider. and I think added the 35% tax. I think the base tax might have been 25 when it left the Senate. And then the Senate concurred with that action, and we adjourned at the end of the session. So the Senate has not, there's always been concern in the Senate that that wasn't as good a policy call as we had hoped, because we had, as I recall, support from the industry on the 25% credit, or 25% tax and a $5 credit. So can you help me with that, Mr. Stickle? If we had that tax structure that the Senate supported, and I'm talking about the majority of the Senate, that wasn't one of them, but the majority of the Senate, what that would look like. And I think that kind of gets to what Senator Wilikowski is asking.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So going back to 2013, Governor Parnell introduced the original version of Senate Bill 21, which had a 25% net profits tax rate and no per taxable barrel credit. The version of Senate Bill 21 that passed the Senate included a 35% net profits tax rate and a $5 per barrel per taxable barrel credit for all production.
So I stand corrected on that. The memory isn't as good as it used to be, I guess. It was 35 and 5.
There were multiples of iterations of this legislation, Mr. Chairman. So,
okay. So if we were to take then the 35% tax rate, leave that in place, and don't do the per barrel slider, cap it at 5, what would be the results in 23? The marginal results at, I think that.
Yeah, so Mr. Chairman, holding all else equal on investment and production, with a $5 per taxable barrel credit for all production, at the forecast oil price, the state would receive about $443 million of additional revenue in fiscal year 2023. And this is actually, this comes from the state fiscal model that's on the Department of Revenue website, and reducing the taxable barrel credit schedule is one of the options that was included in that model, and that may have been the analysis that our deputy commissioner was referring to.
Right. So does that, when you tell me that, what was it, 440?
$443 million at the forecasted oil price.
Okay, we're not going to worry about the three. 440, we'll round it off. I got to keep all this stuff halfway straight. So 440, does that include, is that just severance, or does that include potential any other tax issues other than when you say keep it equal? That's the only component you're changing in the sphere of our production tax.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. So we are not incorporating any potential impacts on company decision making as a result of the tax increase,
or income tax, or property tax, or royalties. All that stuff staying the same.
That's correct.
Okay. Does that, and then we can ask and go into further detail with our consultants on the competitive nature. But we, as I recall, maybe Senator Wilikowski will recall the testimony here at the table on that subject matter.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, there is a legal obligation to produce when the industry can make a reasonable profit. I know that there's a tendency in this building and to talk about how we compare and compete with other states and other nations. That is not the analysis, according to our attorneys, multiple times over the years. The analysis is, can the industry make a reasonable profit? And one of the ways they look at that is by looking at internal rates of return, for example. But we've had testimony on this. It's not how we compete with other countries. When you take out a lease in the state of Alaska, you have a legal obligation to produce when you can make a reasonable profit. That is black letter law. That is the law in every state in the nation. It is the law in Alaska. And so I hope we're not going to go down this road of how do we compete with other countries and other states, because that is a race to the bottom. And I just want to get that out early on and up front. We are not competing against anybody. Thank you.
Okay. And anybody have questions on this slide before we speed on to the next one? Okay, we'll go on to 18.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So slide 18 takes the similar analysis to what we've been walking through on the previous several slides and shows a five-year spread. So we have 2 years of history. We have the current year, fiscal year 2022, and then 2 years of forecast. So, you know, as you can see in fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 20 was a minimum tax floor year, so most companies were paying at the minimum tax. And then in fiscal year 2021, we had some companies who were paying above the minimum tax floor. And for the current year and the next several, and all the future years in the current revenue forecast, actually, we're expecting to receive revenue above and beyond the minimum tax floor.
And can you help us where that trigger point is?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So for the major companies for fiscal year 2023, the price at which those companies start paying above the minimum tax floor is somewhere in the $50 to $70 range. The point at which the state receives greater than the minimum tax floor is around the $50 range, but then again, it does, each company has a different a different relationship between the minimum tax floor and their net tax, depending on the fields they're working in, the investments they're making.
All right. So the policy tool that we'd have here is at 1 point, all consolidated. So can you help us with, if everybody was consolidated and you put it on a chart, what that price per barrel would be? If it would be 50, 55, 70, 72, what is it?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. If we did the aggregate calculation, it would be around $50 per barrel.
Okay. And that would change, I think, as I recall, if the slider was gone and we were at flat $5. I think that had a significant impact on the tipping point.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it would. And I don't have the change in the tipping point off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, you can get back to us on that. It's easy for you to calculate. I know, you just push a button and out it comes. And it is what it is. It's just, you know, we just want all the information on the table. We have, and this is for a point of clarification, on the bottom line there where it says net new lease expenditures earned and carried forward, that's the aggregate liability then in any given year, or would there should be another line as far as the accumulation goes? Help me with that.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the net new lease expenditures are those lease expenditures that would become carried forward annual losses in that given fiscal year.
So can you help us with another line on the bottom of that? That shows the accumulation, the net liability to the state, because that's the concern that, or the issue we want to, well, it's a concern, but it's the issue we need to keep track of.
Absolutely,
and, Mr. Chairman. Understand the mechanics of it and the pros and cons. So if you can do that, and then on the, it'd be nice to do the, you know, we've got the effective rate issue, if you can lay that out also. And again, it is what it is. We just need to know that way everybody's using the same numbers. So we're not seven of us calculating the same number, coming out with different answers. Any questions on 18? Okay, we'll go on to 19.
All right, so slide 19 kind of circles back on this question of aggregate versus company-specific analysis. So this calculation is the same presentation that we've been looking at, but it kind of does a what-if analysis of what if there was a single company on the North Slope. that had all of the investment, all of the production, all of the costs. And what we see is if there were only one taxpayer, we would expect that they would use sliding scale credits to reduce their tax liability. They could not reduce their tax liability below the minimum tax floor. And we would expect, so with a single taxpayer, we'd expect to get about $50 million more revenue. The difference there being, you know, right now we have some companies that are paying below the minimum tax floor. These are primarily companies operating the gross value reduction eligible fields where they are not utilizing the sliding scale credit. And they're instead using the $5 flat per barrel credit to reduce their tax liability below the minimum tax floor. If there was a single taxpayer, that option wouldn't be available. So we would expect to get a little bit more revenue if there was just a single taxpayer. And really the point of this slide is just to illustrate that each company has a different set of economics and a different portfolio of operations and investments. And just to kind of keep that in mind when you're looking at the data.
I asked them to run this slide because we have to work with the rolled up data. And if we, it's hard to drill down into the impacts of some of our minutia as far as our incentives or deductions. And one way of pigeonholing the aggregate is to roll it all up as one company that they can, they have enough revenue to immediately deduct their expenditures and basically see what the delta is. And it was like 50 million, is that the number you use, ballpark?
Thereabouts, Mr. Chairman. So in the official forecast, we were estimating $741.2 million in general fund production tax revenue, and then with a single taxpayer, the estimate would be $794.5 million.
Right, so it's about $40 million, rounded off. We have other questions on this slide. On the last slide, can you walk us through that? That rolls into quite a bit of the discussion that we had here today as far as where the revenue comes from and where our incentives are or aren't. So can you help us with that?
Sure. So slide 20 shows how state petroleum revenues vary by land type. Again, the basic concept is that not all oil is the same, and the revenue that the state gets from oil production does depend on where the oil comes from. For any oil produced in federal waters that are more than 6 miles offshore, the state would not receive any revenue at all. There's currently not any production on the North Slope that falls into this category. For any oil produced within 3 to 6 miles offshore, the state receives 27% of the federal royalty, but taxes do not apply to that oil. Right now, there's a small amount of production that falls into this category, primarily the portion of the North Star oil field that extends beyond the state's 3 mile limit. For anything on state land and up to 3 miles offshore, all taxes apply regardless of the land ownership. This includes the production tax, it includes the state corporate income tax, it includes the property tax. Royalty is where there's a lot of variation depending on who owns the land. So royalty applies to any state land, anything within the 3 mile limit. If the state is the landowner, the state collects a direct royalty. Again, most production is at the 12.5% royalty rate. Some is higher than that. For federally owned land in the National Petroleum Reserve, federal royalty applies, and 50% of those royalties are shared back to the state, but must be used to benefit impacted communities on the North Slope. For federally owned land in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, were that to come into production, federal royalty would apply and 50% would be shared back to the state. Currently, there are no restrictions on how that 50% would be used. For other federal land, the federal royalty applies and 90% would be shared back to the state with, again, no restrictions on how that revenue would be used. For private land, this is primarily a Native corporation-owned land. There's a privately negotiated royalty that applies. The state does tax that private royalty value as part of the production tax, so we have a tax on the private landowner royalty interest.
And Point Thompson, where would that fall in?
Mr. Chairman, so Point Thompson is state-owned leases, so this would be on the third category here of state lands.
Okay. We have questions on this? We'll have that. We should have that slide available, I think, for tomorrow, because we'll be having the discussions. At least I expect some questions on deductibility and versus ownership. Any other questions, concerns? I think that was your last slide. You're looking for the next one. You're looking for number 21.
That's correct. Contact information up on the slide for myself and my tax director if there's any follow-up questions.
Senator Wilkowski and then Wilson.
Yeah, thank you. Could we get copies of the analysis that you did on cutting the oil tax credits?
Sure. Senator Wilkowski through the chair. So that's incorporated into our Department of Revenue fiscal model, which is on the Department of Revenue website, but be happy to break that out and include it in the committee response.
Thank you.
That would be good. And could you maybe email it over to us by 9 in the morning so members may have that tomorrow for questions? Is that a possibility?
I think we could do that.
Okay, yeah, give it a try because the subject's going to come up, so we might as well have the documents in front of us. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stickle, we just want to thank you in our office for your new North Slope oil production, new wells chart. We understand that hasn't been produced in a few years, so thank you for the update.
Sure, and Senator Wilkowski, or Senator Wilson, excuse me, through the chair, just to point out the majority of that analysis was done by the folks over at the Department of Natural Resources, so it's Pascal Amekwe took the lead on that, so credit goes to them.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Stickle this morning? I'd like to thank Mr. Stickle for coming forward and putting up with us every year as we bring you into the office and walk through this internally. I think we missed last year because of COVID, but it's been an annual event for quite some time. In fact, I don't know how long, but years. You looked a lot younger when we started out, so you know, as we've matured, you know, along the way. So that concludes this morning's meeting. Tomorrow at 9 a.m., we're going to have the discussion with our consultants, Gaffney Klein and Associates, on our competitiveness of Alaska's oil and gas regime, along with some of the more detailed questions on mechanics, how things work other places, and what they think is working, and what they think might need some improvement. So we'll see everybody here at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, and we are adjourned.